Hi, everybody. My name is Cheryl Hughes, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, buddy.
This is not my favorite thing to do. But I learned early on in Alcoholics Anonymous that when you're asked to do something here, that you do it. Jack taught me that. Jack used to hang with us, and he decided that he wasn't going to chair one week, and it wasn't too long after that he decided also that he wanted to live like his business partner, and he wanted to drink like him. And Jack had 4 years sobriety, and 3 months later he was dead from this disease. So I learned early on that I need to do what I'm asked to do here. And I can't wait till I can breathe right. And I don't know how I'm going to cut 9-10 years off my life here, but with this 30 minutes. I'm the 7th of 10 children. I was raised in an alcoholic home. My father's an admitted alcoholic. As I knew that it was crazy, he would come home and beat my mother, and I guess the things that we do when we're guilty, tear my brothers out of bed and things like that. And I didn't hate him. All I knew is I was afraid of him. And my first drink was when I was 12 years old. And I don't remember a lot about that other than I laughed a lot and had a lot of fun, and I liked the way I felt. By 15 years of age, I decided my mother, I used to stay out a lot. I started to stay out. We drank wine all the time, and I'd go to school, get off the bus, and we'd go drink all day, never even went in. I guess you could say I graduated from the 9th grade when I was 15. I decided that I knew that all I needed to know in life, I knew at that point. And my mother grounded me a lot because, like I said, I was staying out. And this one particular weekend, I thought she hated me. My younger sister was burnt real bad when she was 2, and that led to a lot of partiality. And she learned how to use that, and she still uses it today. And so I thought my mother hated me, and this one weekend that she grounded me, my attitude was that you don't love me, and I'm going to show you that I don't love you either. And I was grounded, and I told her I was going to go to the corner gas station to get a can of root beer, and she didn't see me or hear from me for 6 months. And this guy that my older sister went to school with, he was in the Navy down in Norfolk, Virginia, and I lived in Pennsylvania. And he told me, you want to get out of here, I got a place you can go. And so for the next 2 weeks, when I went to get that can of root beer, I stayed in town, and the police were looking for me, because you can't quit when you're 15, and unless your parents sign, but they didn't even know where I was. And I always stayed one step ahead of the cops. And the one place where my mother and an older sister found out where I was staying, I wasn't there at this time, and they pulled in the alley, and they saw these people carrying a deer out they had shot out of season, and they knew the police were scouting the area for me, and they were carrying it out down the back stairs in the alley, and my mother thought that that was me. She thought they killed me. And at that point, I didn't know about it, and it wouldn't matter if I did, because I was incapable of caring about anyone or anything, not even myself. And we did hitchhike to Norfolk, Virginia, and in that first month that I was down there, I went from 117 down to 83 pounds. Anything was better than going back home. I did finally go back, and the same guy came back in town, said that he wanted me to go to Long Island with him, said, you want to go and meet a friend of mine I was in the Navy with? I said, sure, I'll go. And so I was off again. And this was my father's first year of sobriety. I never knew him to be any different. He was nuts, that's all I knew. And so I went, and we were a half hour away from this guy's house, drinking all the way up there, and he pulls into a gas station, and we get back out, and he says, you want to drive? I said, sure, I'll drive. I had no glasses, no driver's license. This was a stick shift. I didn't even know how to drive an automatic. And I went about 3 feet and just missed a cop car. And he hollered out the window, what's the matter? Are you drunk? And everything happened really fast. And that was the first time I went to jail. And I'm in there with women that, actually, it was the same time that that guy that killed in Amityville Horror, that movie, it was the same time he blasted his family or whatever he did to him. And Not that it has anything to do with it, but... So I got out. I told him, I'm 16, you know, you can't touch me. And he said, honey, in Long Island, being 16 is the same as being 18. And I stayed in jail, and they called my parents, and they just came back from vacation. And they told him that they needed a $500 bond for me. And he said, let her stay there. He evidently learned something in these rooms, which I was happy that he did that, because I didn't want to go home. No way. And so I got out of there. I'm supposed to go meet this person that we were going to see, that he never met me before. And this is in October. I don't know what happened to my shoes. I got out of jail. I called the guy. He's coming to get me. And he found me right away. I think it's because I described my... I must have been the only person in Long Island with no shoes. I think that's how he found me. And he took me to his house, and I met his parents. And I loved his dad. He was wonderful. He always had a gallon of Paisano wine. And he would sit and drink with me until he found out I was only 16, not 18. And then I had to drink his wine alone. And that was the first time that someone had told me, you know... This guy's mother said, you know, you don't have to live like this. And anyway, I went back to Pennsylvania. This guy got out of jail then. Went to Pennsylvania to make some money for this attorney, and because we knew it was going to be a lot. And he stayed there, and I went back to Long Island to keep the appointment, at which time it went from a seventh degree misdemeanor to a second degree felony. 4 days went by, I'm wondering, where is he at? He left me up here with these people. And I called his mother in Pennsylvania. She said that he left 4 days ago. I think, where is he at? Anyway, he showed up that night, and I guess he was busy. He stole $10,000-some worth of traveler's checks from the bank. And they didn't frown on that, especially when they're closed. And so we were on our way to Vegas. 22 years later, I finally made it, which was last November, for an AA convention. We stopped in Chicago, and that's where three of my two brothers and a sister lived there. And we moved around a lot. My father was in the steel business. And my oldest brother, he was always like my father figure. He would buy me the baby dolls for Christmas, and I did want to stay with him before, and my mother wouldn't let me, so I overdosed and slept for 3 days. But anyway, we were on our way to Vegas. We stopped at a motel in Chicago, and he called his brother back in Pennsylvania, found out that the FBI was looking for him because he was signing these checks with his name. And I stayed in Chicago. He did get caught as soon as he got to Vegas. I stayed there, and I went to my oldest brother's house. And I don't remember much. I remember I met some people, and they drank like I did. And we got along great. I stayed there for a month. My brother put me back on a bus and sent me back to Pennsylvania. It was just crazy. That's just the way that it was. I mean, it accelerated like right away. By 18, I had a son. Father denied the fact that he was his. Saw him one time when he was 7 months old. My father at that time told me, he said, you're going to find out that I'm the best friend you've got. And he meant it. And he's a neat man. And I became close to him. Because he wasn't drinking. I never knew him to be anything but a drunk. And he was there for me. With my mother, I was a pig and a tramp, all those things. But anyway, that's just the way that it was. Every year, my oldest brother told me, you know, finally, back in 84, he said, you know, every time I turn around, he said, you get in trouble. He said, every time you get out of one thing, you're right back into another. I thought, the nerve of that guy. How could he say something like that to me? But he was right. And so I guess this is where I skipped 9 years. It just stayed that way. Meanwhile, two more kids and three rehabs later. The first time I went into rehab was for him. The second time was physical. My blood alcohol was 0.46. I had pancreatitis. I'm throwing up blood. The whole thing, and I'm ashamed. I mean, I'm throwing this up and throwing it out before the nurses see it. I'm so ashamed. And I'm thinking, you know, this is cool. We're like, when I got arrested, I can't wait to tell my friends. You know, this is really cool. I'm acting so tough on the outside, and I'm dying on the inside, and I'm full of fear. And it just stayed that way. I was always full of fear. And What a life. The last rehab that I was in, we decided that I've been taught all I can be taught about alcoholism. It was time for me to get out and apply. That rehab was because the judge said so. Finally, the last night that I drank, I was angry at him, my kid's father, because he had a girlfriend when I was in rehab. How dare he? And I found out and I met her. And I did have 6 months dry at that time, but I was still too afraid to go to meeting. And had I been going to meetings, is what I would have done the day that I met this woman. But instead, I went to the bar and started the thing all over again. I was afraid to go to meetings, not because I thought I was better than you, but I wasn't good enough. And so this last night that I drank, I went back to Michigan, and my mother didn't know that I was drinking for the past 8 months. And I know this whole time I'm thinking, God, I have to quit this before I end up in the hospital again. And I went to Jackson and I called that sister that B word, and my mother hated it. You don't mess with that girl, you know, and you still don't. You still don't say anything against her. Anyway, I went home that night and I'm throwing things around. I'm in and out of a blackout and I'm screaming at him, you know, I want you out of here, and crying. I sat down and I said, God, I don't want to be this way anymore. And he heard me. I had no clue that that would be the last night that I drank. I went to a meeting that I found out that his mother went to when she had a DUI, and I hated her. She used to call me from the bar and tell me, you better quit your drinking, and she decided we should move to Texas, so we did the whole thing. I hated her, and she hated me. And I had no idea what that first drink was gonna, where it was gonna take me. And the same as the first meeting that I finally went to, that I surrendered to the fact that I can't do this anymore. I had no idea what kind of life I was gonna have today. I know God really loves me. He blessed me with three beautiful women down here in Columbus that I didn't ask for. I don't know what he's trying to teach me, but I know he loves me, placed them in my life. I believe that I took the first three steps that night that I said, God, I don't want to be this way anymore. As far as the insanity goes, you know, the dictionary talks about sanity as being soundness of mind. I definitely did not have that. The insanity for me was to get these little periods of not drinking and thinking that I could go out and do this again, and this time I'm going to do it right. This time I'll drink beer, I'll drink wine, and I'll be fine. It always got worse right away. The fourth and fifth step, I know that when I was ready to do it, my inventory at 8 months, my sponsor at that time told me, wait till you have a year. Our book does not say that. Right after step three, it says, next we launched into a program of rigorous action, that being house cleaning, personal house cleaning. So I'm a great procrastinator. A year and a half goes by. I'm starting to go to Cleveland at this time because I met Don and Don Cassini, blast his anonymity. He doesn't have anonymity. And I met him and his sponsor at a convention when I had a year. So I started to go to Cleveland, and I'd get up there and say, you do your inventory yet? And I'd say, no, why not? How long you want to stay sick? And they just pound it. So finally, a year and a half, you know, I'm praying about this to do my inventory, and I'm thinking, you know, God's going to put all these thoughts in my head, and I'm going to have a pen, and everything's going to flow. Not so. I put myself in another situation that was very painful to me, and it forced me to take a look at myself. And that's how I did it. And they took me down to Tiffin to meet a priest, Father Atkins, and I got there, and something that I had left out of my inventory that I didn't tell my sponsor at that time, go to meet this priest, and he says, hi. He says, leave her alone with me 20 minutes. She's got something on her mind. Well, how did he know that? I just met him. So something I couldn't tell my sponsor, he takes me in this little room with these vents in the door. I have to scream it because he's bucking 90 and he can't hear me. Says, admit nothing. I had to get my hearing aid, and that's what he said. I thought, oh my God. You know, our 12 and 12 talks about, you know, we have to watch. The big book talks about, you know, the sixth step. All we have is the willingness to to have God remove the things that we've already admitted objectionable in step five. Okay, that's the willingness. The 12 and 12 talks about, you know, we have to watch for gossip here. Gossip in the program. I believe it has the power to kill. 12 and 12 talks about that. Gossip barbed with anger is a mild form of murder by character assassination. And I believe that there's someone that needs to be here tonight, and gossip's keeping them away. And I know that because it happened to me at 3 years sobriety. And that's why I believe it has the power to kill. 8 and 9, how many minutes do I have? It's dead. So I got an hour, right? I know these men's 2.5 years in the program, and I'm thinking, you know, because my sister reminded me that at the time that I had run, before I ran away, I had let my mother know, you know, that if you don't learn how to treat me, that I have friends that will blow you away. And I didn't know about that. I found out that in sobriety. And I found out in sobriety where she used to lay in her bed and look at the clock. It reflected the time on the ceiling, and she'd say, "Oh my God, it's 2 o'clock. She's not coming home again tonight." And I'm thinking about this, and I got to make amends to this woman, and it's so hard. And I'm thinking, geez, 2.5 years in the program. All right, I'm ready. I hop out of bed. She lives in Michigan. I live in Toledo. And I called her up. No answer. I guess I'm not supposed to do it that way. The next time I went up there, and she brought it up. We're at the kitchen table, and she started to talk about when I ran away. And so I said, "You know, and I'm praying, oh God, please help me with this. Why I didn't have the courage, I don't know, humbling, whatever." And I just told her, I said, "You know, Mom, I'm really sorry for that." And she slapped her hand on the table, and she said, "I can't believe you said that." Why would she? It took me 14 years to even mutter anything like I was sorry about that. And she proceeded to tell me everything she went through when I ran away. And I'm thinking, oh God, here we go. And then I thought, no, you better listen to her, because this is what you did. And she cried and I cried, and that broke down all the walls that had been put up between us. And I went home that night, and I was pretty free. But I got to thinking, you know, all those years, you know, that telling her I'm sorry wasn't enough for me. She became ill. I used to take her to Pennsylvania, 408 miles, drop her off at my sister's. They got resentments because she wouldn't want to come home for a month, but I'd go back and pick her up. And I'm thinking, how much is enough? You know, how much is enough to make amends to my mother for what I did to her? 2 years ago, she had to have surgery, and the husband that I married in the program allowed me to go up there, and he tore her carpet out. We knew she was going to be bedridden for a while, and she's been pretty sick off and on, in and out of the hospital for the past couple years. And he went up and tore her carpet out. We went and picked out the best mattresses we could find, because we knew she was going to be there for a while. And she got out, and we redid her whole room, and she got home, and she said, "Boy, this is really nice. I have to pay you some money for this." And I said, "No, Ma, I owe you." And she said, "I want you to go out in the kitchen and look on the refrigerator. There's a little poem that I cut out of the paper. And the first line on it says, 'You owe me nothing, my children dear. It is I who owe you.'" 2 years ago, I finally forgave myself for what I put her through. I'm finally free of that. The oldest brother that I stayed at, I had to finally make amends to him, and I went out to see him, and I told him, "Gary, you know, I'm really sorry for what I did to you." And he said, "Don't worry about it. You were just a kid." I said, "No, I need to do this." And he worked nights, and he got off, and he came home that morning, and he made a beautiful breakfast. He made omelets and muffins, and he had a fresh picked rose on the table, and that told me that it was okay. How do you make amends to the 5-year-old boy that you take out of the house and take him to a place where you can drink as much as you want, the way you want, and you wake up and you hear him crying because he's crouched in the corner on the couch because he sees a rat playing on the steps? How do you make amends for that? And when you tuck him in bed at night and he tells you, he looks up with his big blue eyes and says, "Boy, I wish I had a dad." How do you do that? I had written a letter to his father one time. It was when I had about 2 years sobriety, and I couldn't find him. And when I went for this child support thing, I kind of looked over the desk, and saw his address. And I sent him a letter. I said, I understand you're married now, and I don't want to cause any problems, but Sean would like to know you. And I sent him some pictures, and I said, and if you don't want these, please send them back. Don't throw them away. I didn't hear a thing. He was 16 years old, and I got to thinking, you know, this is the last legal chance I really have to find him, you know, let him meet him. He paid child support all these years. And so I called Pennsylvania, and they set up an appointment for me to come in and do this child support modification, whatever. And I didn't have to be there because I didn't live in the state. And I went, and he was very surprised. And I took my son. We were in the motel, and I'm thinking, God, what did I do to this boy? Trying to prepare him for the worst. Go there the next day, and he hopped up. I told him Sean was there. And he ran out, and he got a hold of his wife. Here, she's been telling him all these years, you know, they never got the letter. They moved. And she's been telling him all these years, you know, try to look him up, and he didn't want to because he was worried about, you know, he didn't want to mess up his life. And he took him home, and my son's little half-brother thought that his daddy went to the courthouse that day and bought him a brother. And it's just kind of neat, and my husband let them and his four kids and his wife, the best stepmother I could ever imagine for him, couldn't have picked a better one, and they came and stayed at our house, and they got acquainted. Now the curiosity for him is gone. Just neat things, and you gave that to me. Did I hear a beeper? It was you. The woman that I hated so much took me 6 years in the program to make amends to her because she was on my never list, and you taught me that I need to be honest, and I hated her, and I was going to hang on to that for a while. And she came to pick up the grandkids one day, and I told her, you know, at a bar, she's drinking her beer, just one. And I told her, you know, Kath, I'm really sorry. And she said, you know, I think the best thing that could have ever happened to him is if he would have stayed with you. My sick thinking, she said, yeah, because he's with you now, that's what I'm thinking, but you can't control what comes into your mind, you can control how long it stays there. And I thought, no, she really meant that. She was sincere. I don't know. And I was free of that. She just passed away a couple months ago. She had cancer. And I'm free. I don't have to live with that. I made my amends to her. I'm going to jump right to 12 because I'm out of time and I know that. You know, we can talk gratitude here all we want. I think the gratitude is when you get out and you're working with a new person. You know, I could say I'm grateful, but I'm not if I'm going to sit at home and I'm going to be into myself. And that's when I'm the most miserable anyway. And I'm not very good company when I'm not doing things. And God's really blessed me with them. And it was neat coming down here in March. Got to meet some neat people. And that just took off. And I want to thank you for being here for me when I was finally ready for you. And thanks, Cindy, for asking me. Thank you.